Support for this podcast comes from California Institute of the Arts. CalArts, educating artists who embrace creative experimentation and transform the world through the visual and performing arts. More at calarts.edu.
This approval today will enable care, emergency care, life-saving care, to be given on the spot when it's needed, whether you're in a clinic or a hospital or on the street.
That's FDA Commissioner Margaret Hamburg announcing the approval of a new device that can be used on someone overdosing on drugs. The FDA says a person dies every 36 minutes from a drug overdose in the United States. And the agency believes this new product, it's called Evzio, can help cut those numbers. Others are concerned, though, it's the wrong way to combat the country's growing opioid problem. Joining me now is Dr. David Sack. He's an addiction specialist and CEO of Promises Treatment Center. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for inviting me, Madeline.
Well, could you describe how this device works?
Sure. So we've had a drug, naloxone, for more than 25 years that blocks the effects of an opiate drug. So it reverses the potential lethal effects of an opiate as well as the getting high from the opiate. And we've used that as a rescue medicine by paramedics and in hospitals. But the truth is most people who overdose at home or when they're too far from an emergency treatment setting to get help. And so the new medicine was revised so that it could be put into a device specifically intended for either self-administration or more likely non-professional administration by someone who's with you and can administer in time to save your life.
So it's an injected drug into the muscle.
That's right. It's given intramuscularly in the thigh. It's a very simple procedure, and it's set up so that just anybody who has had minimal instruction can use this medicine to save a life.
And how would friends or family members know when to use it?
When someone, first of all, they have to know that the person is using opiates. And in many instances, if someone is a recreational or habitual drug user, family members are aware of it. If the person becomes excessively drowsy and unarousable, if their breathing becomes slow and shallow, it's likely that they're at a point where they're at risk to have an overdose.
But do most people who overdose, do they overdose with people near them or do they overdose alone?
Well, people often use drugs with friends and colleagues and hang out with people who use drugs. So if we're talking about the population of people who are using drugs recreationally, there is often someone else there because they're partying with friends. So there is likely to be someone who could administer this and make a difference. Over half of the overdoses, though, from prescription opiates occur in people who are not using them recreationally but are having reactions where they're combining those drugs with other drugs and there are unintended consequences that are accidental. And in many instances, there may be a family member or a caregiver that's overseeing that care who could administer the drug.
So more than 16,000 people a year are dying of these overdoses from prescription painkillers. Do you see this as being able to substantially cut those numbers?
Well, you know, it's always hard to get a new treatment out into the community, but we're in an epidemic. The number of deaths due to overdoses has risen from about 8,000 in 1980 to almost 40,000 a year in 2008. We're probably over 40,000 a year now. So we have a lot of people whose lives are on the stake. So we don't know how many more people will be saved this way, but we know that we have to try to make a difference. No one thinks that this is an effective treatment for addiction, but people with addiction are in and out of treatment, and they're often at the highest risk of overdose when they relapse. So someone who's been doing well and then relapses is at a much higher risk to have an overdose. And so, you know, we have to take the view that there are many people who want to overcome their addictions who are going to die if we don't provide emergency treatment in a way that's accessible.
Well, some people are afraid that this is going to actually encourage people to party harder, if you will. If they know that they have an antidote nearby, they could maybe think, oh, well, I can just take more of this drug.
You know, life doesn't really work that way. No one seriously considers the risk of an overdose and then takes the drug anyway. So, you know, the people who are taking excessive quantities of opiate pills in combination of alcohol and other sedatives in a party setting are not standing there worrying that they may overdose. So breaking through their denial is going to be very difficult anyway. So people are not choosing to get high and to party on drugs based on how safe they are. And I think that we're not going to see an increase in opiate use above what we're already seeing as a result of this drug. We're in an opiate epidemic now. People are dying every day. And I think we're putting a premium on preserving life to say, let's save a life and hopefully we can get them care and treatment.
Well, speaking of, there was some controversy last fall when the FDA approved a new drug called Zohydro. It's a powerful painkiller. And, you know, some people were saying, a lot of attorneys general were saying, you, FDA, are adding to this problem. What do you think about that?
Well, Zohydro is, again, a formulation of a medicine that we've had for many years. But most of the prescription opiates are sold with acetaminophen, which is the active ingredient in Tylenol, as part of the mixture in the pill. So you get the opiate medicine and you get Tylenol. The acetaminophen, though, is very toxic to the liver. And so there are a lot of overdoses that involve prescription opiates where the individual doesn't stop breathing, but their liver is injured by the acetaminophen. And so the argument there is that we can prevent numerous cases of liver failure by having a version of this medicine that does not have acetaminophen in it. And we can make a safer medicine that way. Now, the other side of that problem, though, is that it creates a safer version of hydrocodone for people to abuse. So that's the risk that the addictionologists like myself are worried about, that now there's a version that people can tell themselves is safer. It remains to be seen how much that changes things.
Are you seeing people who are addicted to this now?
Well, we see people who are addicted to hydrocodone in the form of Vicodin and other preparations all the time. And they're taking hundreds of Vicodin a week at times. So they're taking enough to seriously damage their livers.
Dr. David Sack is an addiction psychiatrist and CEO of Promises Treatment Center. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Well, 2 weeks ago, Brendan Eich was appointed CEO of Mozilla. That's the maker of the popular Firefox web browser. Yesterday, he resigned. A popular firestorm has erupted over a $1,000 donation he made in 2008 to a campaign for Prop 8. That was California's anti-gay marriage initiative that passed. 70,000 people had signed a petition calling for him to step down. And the popular dating service, OkCupid, had put a letter on its homepage saying, Mozilla's new CEO, Brendan Eich, is an opponent of equal rights for gay couples. We would therefore prefer that our users not use Mozilla software to access OkCupid. But now, though, there's a backlash against the backlash. Popular gay rights blogger Andrew Sullivan wrote yesterday, if this is the gay rights movement today, hounding our opponents with a fanaticism more like the religious right than anyone else, then count me out. Nick Bilton is a technology reporter for the New York Times in San Francisco. He writes the Bits blog. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so this seems to have happened very fast. Tell us what happened. What was the timeline here?
Well, everything on the internet seems to happen very fast these days, especially with opinions. You know, as you said, he was appointed CEO less than 2 weeks ago, actually. In 2008, he had made this $1,000 donation to support Proposition 8, which, you know, as you said, goes against gay marriage. It had been relatively quiet until the Los Angeles Times put out an application in 2012 that allowed you to search people's names, and someone had gone in there and searched his name and found that he had actually given this donation and that he worked at Mozilla. And there was about a week of backlash. You know, there was people that tweeted about it. There was a couple of media reports and so on. But it kind of all went away after that. When he was appointed CEO, internally, people didn't think that it was going to be that big of a deal because of the way it had kind of blown over a year and a half earlier. But yet when he was appointed CEO, there was a tremendous backlash on Twitter, in the media. And now, as he stepped step down, it's kind of turned in the other direction. And so you have people that are saying, hey, you know, if we don't support free speech, well, what do we support? And what is the point of the internet if we can't even let people have their own views?
Right. And did the OKCupid letter, did that really galvanize the opposition?
I think it did. I think, you know, what happened with the OKCupid letter was that you have a company that said, hey, you know, we're going to stand up to this. And I think that it's one thing for people to be upset and to have different views and to voice those opinions, but it's another thing when it actually starts to affect the company. And part of the reason that that Brendan Eich was put in as CEO is because Mozilla, the maker of Firefox, is trying to expand, and they're trying to grow mobile, they're trying to grow users. As it stands right now, they account for about 20% of all the browser traffic online. When you compare that to Google's Chrome, which is at 43%. That's a big difference. And so once you start seeing businesses that are saying, hey, we're not going to support this, that's when I think the backlash started to happen internally too.
Yeah. Well, aside from that, did Eich have a good reputation in terms of being able to turn that company around and make it grow?
Well, there's certain people that say he did and certain people that say he didn't. You know, he was incredibly well respected in the company. He is, he created JavaScript programming language, which is essentially what makes most websites run today. It's a really powerful tool. He was at Netscape when he eventually started Firefox. And he, you know, is a very, very capable programmer. He was CTO for a long time. And he was well respected in the community, with the exception of this view on gay marriage. But that being said, there were some members of the board who didn't think that he would be the right CEO, and not necessarily because of his views on gay marriage, but they felt that they needed to bring someone from the outside into the company that was going to be able to really kind of push the business further along than it is today.
Right, because he was one of the founders back in 1998, and
yeah,
so he'd been
correct.
With the company for a long time.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So let's talk a little bit more about the backlash to the backlash. Is that now gaining steam that he basically?
While we're on the phone, there could be backlash to the backlash to the backlash. So you never know at the speed. I think that, you know, it's usually I wrote an article a few months ago. Do you remember the Justine Sacco debacle?
No.
She was a PR executive at AIC, the internet company, and she had tweeted a pretty bad racial joke, and the internet went into a firestorm, and they demanded that she was fired, and it got very serious. People were threatening her family, and there was a lot of derogatory comments that were said towards her online, and she was fired very quickly. And I think what happens in these instances is you have kind of this mob mentality that sometimes, sure, we all have different views, and we all have different opinions, and that I think is what makes the internet so beautiful and wonderful, is that anyone can voice those on an equal platform. But sometimes I think things get out of hand, and I think in this instance, there were certain people that came out and said, he should be fired, he should not be running the company, which is understandable considering that it is such an open company and it's an open source company. And there were other people that said, hey, look, that's his personal views. If it doesn't affect the way he runs the company, then so be it. And I think that there were people, what's interesting is I've seen people that were commenting online that something should be done about it. But then when he was fired, those same people were commenting online saying, did we go too far?
Interesting.
Yeah.
Well, interesting because Silicon Valley is such a libertarian place in many ways.
Oh, absolutely. It's incredibly libertarian. There are founders of companies that have, Ayn Randers their Twitter avatar icons and things like that. And I think that, it's interesting because what I find fascinating about this particular instance is that, Firefox and Mozilla, it's an open source platform, and it's an incredibly open company where things are put online from meeting notes and so on are all shared online. People are allowed to tweet whatever they want about whatever they want that work in the company, and they're allowed to blog about anything. And yet internally, there were a lot of people that demanded his resignation a week into his appointment and weren't open to necessarily having him as CEO.
Very interesting. Yeah. Well, so what is his future? He probably has a pretty good one, right? If he's good in any way in running.
Well, he's. I mean, I think as a programmer, I'm sure he has he could do whatever he wants. He's one of the best that there is out there. It's going to be interesting to see, how he responds to this. I mean, he wrote a note on his blog yesterday saying that you know, he's really cares about programming and open source and making the web and the world a better place. And you know, bearing the lead, he said, you know, he's going to take some time with his family and then get back to work. And you know, I think he'll go on to do great things. I think that, you know, he may have been stung by this. I spoke to him on Tuesday for a story, and he said, you know, I asked him if he had any plans to resign, and he said he had no plans, and that he, you know, he sat as the CEO at the appointment of the board, and yet 2 days later, he was out of the company.
It happens fast. Nick Bilton, yep. Tech reporter for the New York Times in San Francisco. Thanks.
Thank you.
All right. Let us know what you think. Are a CEO's personal political leanings relevant? Was it right for Brendan Eich to be forced to leave Mozilla? You can leave us a voicemail at 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can weigh in on our Facebook, KCRW's Press Play. Coming up, we will be doing our weekly film segment. We're going to take a look at some of the blockbusters that are being released today, whether they're any good. Captain America, we'll see what the critics are saying, and a lot more coming up on Press Play.
Do you like KCRW on Facebook? If not, you're missing out on the latest music updates, program exclusives, and in-studio video clips. Join the conversation at facebook.com/KCRW.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Every Friday, we talk film, new releases, and the business. And today,
double rainbow all the way across the sky.
Yeah, we'll have more on that later. Joining us here in the studio, John Horn covers the business of Hollywood for the LA Times, and also he's a contributor to KCRW's The Business. Hi, John.
Hello, Madeline.
And Sharon Knoll writes on all things film for Movie Phone and the pop culture site Forces of Geek. Hi. Okay, let's start with the juggernaut of the weekend, and that is Captain America, The Winter Soldier. And here's a little clip from the movie.
Most of the intelligence community doesn't believe he exists. The ones that do call him the Winter Soldier. He's a ghost. You'll never find him.
Scarlett Johansson is the Black Widow, Chris Evans, Captain America, and really, this is going to be a massive movie, right, Sharon?
Yes, it's gotten a huge boost, I think, from the Avengers, because I think a lot of people did not see the first Captain America movie. It was set in World War II. I think maybe he wasn't as known of a brand back then. But now people fell in love with him in the Avengers, which was huge. This won't be as big as the Avengers, but people are predicting it's going to be bigger than the last Thor movie.
Yeah, pretty big. I mean, the early numbers, it opened last night, so did a lot of business Thursday. The projections are it could do as much as $100 million in its first weekend, which would be the biggest opening of the year. Crush the Lego movie, and probably crush Noah as well. So it's going to be a huge opening and another huge hit for Marvel.
And Captain America, obviously about America, opened first abroad.
Overseas. Yeah, and it did very well. I mean, I think that's what's amazing about these Marvel characters. Hollywood loves to find movies that can travel, and a lot of these action movies, these Marvel movies, do better business overseas than they do domestically. True for the Avengers, true for Iron Man, and probably will be true for Captain America based on the early numbers so far.
So it broke advanced ticket sales records, I understand. And so all things point well for it, but not for Noah, as you said earlier, which is in its second weekend. And so this is the end of Noah?
I don't know if it's actually going to be kind of, you know, go down with in the tide of Captain America, but I think it'll be a tough challenge because Noah does play to an older audience. But I think the thing that's worth noting about Captain America is the reviews have been fantastic. I mean, generally when major critics go to review these kinds of movies, there's so many disclaimers and you can kind of almost picture them wandering in the theater. I know I'm going to hate this. Why am I going to this? And then the reviews that they've written about this film have been incredibly positive. So that does tend to attract an older moviegoer who looks at reviews. Noah is a polarizing movie. So I think it is going to hurt Noah. Inevitably, whenever a movie does $100 million, everything else kind of suffers in its wake.
Okay, another movie also starring Scarlett Johansson is a movie called Under the Skin, and it's an alien sex thriller.
That, to call it a sex thriller is a real misnomer. And if you're going into it to see a sex thriller, you're going to be vastly disappointed. Yes, Scarlett Johansson gets naked. Yes, mysterious things happen. But It's very slowly paced. It's definitely an art house movie. It's very abstract and nonlinear. It's like a cult movie that I don't really think is for a lot of people. I myself did not really like it.
John?
I love the movie, but it does remind me of something a film buyer said to me a couple of years ago at the Sundance Film Festival after watching an equally strange film. His remark was, interesting movie, not for people.
aliens will love it.
I think it's a fascinating movie. And the director, Jonathan Glazer, did Sexy Beast. He did Birth, a Nicole Kidman film. The way in which the movie was made is fascinating. Scarlett Johansson was put in this van that was equipped with little cameras. And the filmmaker said, cruise these cities or in Scotland. Try to get lure people into the van where they will meet a very bad end. And if they agree to come in the van, we'll get releases. We'll put them in the movie. So it's a fascinating twist on how the movie was made, that Scarlett Johansson was actually playing the character in real time during the making of the film.
Oh, that is fascinating. And did anyone say, no, I don't want to be a part of it?
Well, the odd thing is that very few people recognized her because they were kind of in the middle of nowhere. But it's unscripted, as you can kind of tell. It doesn't follow a clear narrative. I think it's a fascinating, provocative film. It's very polarizing.
So it's polarizing in this room because you hate it.
Clearly.
I see that.
Towards the end, something started to coalesce for me, but it came really just too late to really win me over.
Okay, another movie opening this weekend, which got really good reviews, is Afflicted, and let's hear a clip from that.
We're about to bust in on Derek and the girl he just picked up.
Call an ambulance. Here. Wake up! Call an ambulance!
What happened?
I don't know. I don't remember.
Okay, so this is a horror movie, and it's one of those found footage movies, so kind of like the Blair Witch Project.
One of those, meaning number 473. I mean, it's a genre that has worked incredibly well, but if you look at kind of the mother of all of these films is the Paranormal Activity movies, and they're certainly getting a little long in the tooth and not succeeding as well. This is coming out in limited release, but the reviews, as you said, have been very positive.
Yeah, I think a lot of people, well, it's not a Hollywood movie, and it's easy to make a horror film, you know, with no stars. And there's a built-in genre for that. I mean, built-in audience, I should say. I'm looking at reviews on the review when We Got This Covered. They are saying that it redefines the genre. And one of the main characters is actually...
Which John says needs some redefining.
Exactly. Oh, that phrase?
Every year. Every week.
Redefines the genre. One of the characters is dying. And so they go on a road trip together. And then something else starts happening to him. And so I think, like any good horror film, it sounds like it's more about, you know, about more than just cheap scares, you know, about our mortality, that kind of thing. So that's why I'm thinking it's getting these great reviews.
Yeah. And I mean, it's not going to do huge business. It's opening a limited release, but...
And on video on demand.
Exactly. It's one of those day and date things. You can find it wherever you want. It might be on KCRW. God knows.
Wow. Then it would really have made it. Okay. Harry Potter fans, there's yet another version of Harry Potter, right? This is the spinoff Fantastic Beasts and Where to Find Them. And this was from a book that was actually in the book.
Well, they mention it in the book. And yeah, then she wrote a separate actual book.
Right.
It's really just a guide.
So now it's going to be three movies?
The fact is, I don't think it'll be padded as much as, say,
the Hobbit
movies. Yes. Because for one thing, the author is alive and she can add things. And it's partly going to be a biography of this guy, Newt Scamander, who's a magizoologist. He's like Hagrid, if you guys know the Harry Potter movies. And it'll be about all these, obviously, fantastical creatures. I can imagine a lot of interesting stories coming out of this. Three seems like a good number. More than that would be excessive, probably.
Yeah, but there's not really. I mean, it's not like when Harry Potter films were coming out, they were right on the heels of the books, and the books had a huge following. These books have not been nearly as big by a large measure than the Harry Potter books. So I don't know what kind of benefit they get from the books themselves. Harry Potter as a publishing and movie enterprise were inextricably linked, and this is not quite that close a relationship.
Okay, now, finally, the moment we have all been waiting for.
Double rainbow all the way across the sky. Oh my God. What does this mean?
Oh. Okay, what does it mean that this is going to be the subject of a documentary? What do you think?
Well,
this is a viral video.
It got 39 million views. And the guy himself, he's just a very interesting character. And you can't have a documentary without somebody interesting.
Well, so is Grumpy Cat.
Yes. Well, so this Icelandic filmmaker... funded it through Kickstarter. It's already halfway done, from what I understand. He sounds like, you know, really interesting guy. He's also a former MMA combatant, so I don't know if we're going to see part of that.
Really? That
yes.
guy?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so if you give it a bad review, he will come in and put you in a headlock and until you tap out and
he
give him a good
like
review.
He seems like that guy. He seems like a peace-loving, understanding
guy. Yeah, he's a former
guy.
Firefighter, mixed martial artist, and he's now living in Yosemite National Park where he filmed this, so.
Stranger things have worked.
It's not going to be a franchise.
Spinoff.
It's not the next Captain America. Let's put it that way.
All right. John Horn, he covers the business of Hollywood for the LA Times. He's also on KCRW's The Business, and Sharon Knoll, who writes for Movie Phone and the pop culture site Forces of Geek. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, Were You a Heather? We'll look back at the iconic teen movie Heathers and its dark take on the high school social pecking order. After this news update with Eric Roy.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. When you think about kids picking on each other in school, who do you think suffers the most? The awkward, shy kids? Well, think again. A new study says popular students actually feel more unhappy about being bullied than the kids with less social status. Robert Ferris is an associate professor of sociology at UC Davis, and he co-authored this study. Welcome to the program.
Thanks very much for having me.
Well, it's my pleasure. How did you conduct this study?
Well, we collected data from a little over 4,200 adolescents from 19 schools in North Carolina, and we followed them over the course of a year, a whole school year, and we were collecting information about their friendship patterns, who they were friends with, and also who had been picking on them and doing cruel things to them, and who they had been doing those sorts of things to as well.
And then you found that it was actually the kids with more social status who reported being picked on more?
Yeah, we actually found sort of evidence of what we consider a traditional perspective on bullying, which is that kids who we identified as vulnerable, who had characteristics that might make them vulnerable to bullying in the traditional sense, we did find elevated risk. So we looked at kids who were physically underdeveloped, kids who had no friends at all, and kids who had very poor body image. And all those factors increase the risk of being picked on. So we find evidence of that traditional pattern, but we also found evidence of a second pattern of bullying and harassment, which is that as kids increased their social status, they were increasingly targeted by their peers. And we think what this reflects is a process of jockeying for social position. These are relatively high-status kids going after other high-status kids, often within their own friendship group. But what one interesting additional twist to this is that once kids approach the very top of the hierarchy, roughly around the 95th percentile of social status, the risk of being targeted begins to reverse and plummet.
So the queen bees, the homecoming king and queen, they don't get bullied.
In our data, that's what we find. They're sort of, you know, so basically the climb up the social ladder is fraught with a lot of antagonism and pain. But at some point, for the kids who make it to the top rung, they kind of are offered a safe perch above the fray.
And when you talk about being picked on and bullying, what are you talking about exactly?
We're talking about a very wide range of behaviors. So, this can involve, we see a fair amount of physical violence, but we more commonly we see a lot of sort of direct verbal abuse and an increasing amount of what we call indirect aggression, where kids are gossiping about each other, engaging in cyberbullying. They are trying to ostracize each other, shun fellow members of a group. And so that, I think, is becoming increasingly common as kids are aging. In elementary school, we see more physical and very direct forms, but things become more subtle as kids enter high school.
And you call it instrumental targeting. You have a term in your
paper. So we think of this first traditional pattern where kids who are different are getting picked on. We refer to that as normative targeting, because these are kids who are violating, you know, unintentionally and beyond their control. They're violating some of the unwritten rules of high school life. You know, they don't look right. They don't dress right. They don't maybe express gender in the way that other kids think they should. And they're getting picked on for those reasons. But there's a second process where these are, and this is why these kids are kind of harder to see as victims, because they seem to be very popular, well liked. You would think they would be very well adjusted, but they're actually coming under a lot of fire from kids who are competitive with them in terms of their social positions.
Do you find that the bullies are also the bullied, that it goes back and forth?
We do. We see high. It's not necessarily immediate, but we do see evidence. So, if at time one, in the fall, if a kid is being aggressive, that does increase the risk that they will be a victim in the spring.
I mean, is it something that is just naturally in us, that we are competitive animals and that we will turn to violence, whether it's social or physical, to get ahead?
Well, some would take that view. I am more optimistic than that. I like to think that, you know, there are a lot of things that can be done to reduce this and eliminate this pattern.
Robert Ferris is an associate professor of sociology at UC Davis. Thanks so much for joining us.
Like my friends.
Yeah, I don't really like your friends either.
It's just like there are people I work with and our job is being popular and
High school bullying is a popular theme in movies, and there's one in particular that defines the genre. Before Mean Girls, before Bring It On or Clueless, there was Heathers.
How very.
This week, Heathers turned 25, and a Broadway musical based on the film opened. And like a high school loser who goes on to make a fortune in tech, Heathers was a flop when it opened in 1989, but it rose to cult status in the years since. Starring Winona Ryder and Christian Slater, Heathers still feels edgier than most teen films today. Daniel Waters is a screenwriter and director. He wrote Heathers, and he's on the line now. Hi.
Hello.
25 years ago, it's kind of hard to believe.
Oh, geez. I'm tired of making the joke all week that I wrote it when I was 10, that I was a Mozart prodigy, but I have to do it.
Well, what inspired you to write the movie? Did it come out of your own experiences in any way?
Well, in a way, I mean, I think it was more my high school class actually wasn't that bad when I think about it. I think it's because we listened to a lot of Steely Dan, but my sister was definitely a Veronica, and things got darker for me in college when I started listening to The Cure, and I'd say middle school destroys everyone, so it kind of came from those feelings too. But I think it was I came at it more through my head than my heart, that as far as like I was more, it was less an autobiographical piece than a way to deal with that the other teen films at the time, that I thought I wasn't seeing the movie I wanted to see. You have to remember that the 80s were a time where culturally everyone was Wang Chunging and Walking on Sunshine, and movies about teens were sweet and silly and pink. And, you know, I think Heathers was the stick I used to knock the pinata of maggots that was silently dangling above the decade.
And it is a really dark movie for people who haven't seen it or don't remember. It's about two kids, played by Winona Ryder and Christian Slater, who murder some of their classmates but make it look like they committed suicide.
Wow, that doesn't sound funny, but...
It doesn't, and it's really, you know, you kind of watch it now thinking, oh my gosh. But this is a pre-Columbine, you know, pre-mass school shootings era where it was edgy in a safe way, if I can put it that way?
Well, yeah, we're still operating in the realm of fantasy. Who knew this kind of thing would go on the menu of reality? Like, I don't think anybody could have thought that.
Yeah. Okay, well, I want to play a clip of tape from the movie that comes after two popular jocks, Kurt and Ram, are murdered by Winona Ryder and Christian Slater's characters. And the main characters, they write a fake suicide note, basically portraying Kurt and Ram as secret lovers.
If there's any way you can hear me, Kurt, buddy. I don't care that you really were some pansy. You're my own flesh and blood, and no, you made me proud. My son's a homosexual, and I love him. I love my dead gay son.
So that's the dad.
Yes, well, I think there were so many made-for-TV movies at the time about suicide, and they always had the scene where the parent who picks on the kid and hates the kid for the first hour of the movie, after the kid commits suicide, suddenly they love their child and all their foibles are the greatest things ever. And it's kind of like, I would just crack up watching these made-for-TV movies. They're played completely earnestly and solemnly.
Yeah, and the movie, though, has a serious note in the sense that I found that it really skewers the lazy cynicism of adults, homophobia, this vapid popular jock culture, and also the media's exploitation of teens, and this, as you were saying, lots of movies on teen suicide at the time.
Well, it's been an interesting week celebrating this 25th anniversary that I've had a lot of people come up to me talking about, like, what Heather's meant to them, and I realized that sometimes telling someone life is as wicked and horrible as you think is more comforting than telling them everything's going to be okay. That they like having this confirmation that of all the terrible stuff that's going on with a comic twist.
I'm wondering, where did you get all the lines? There are some famous lines in Heather's. We heard one, I love my dead gay son. How very?
My main goal at the beginning was not to try to capture the way kids really talk, because I always think that's, an enterprise that you're going to lose. It's kind of like trying to capture the light of a star of a planet that blew up 200,000 years ago. You have to kind of, I came at it kind of, not to make myself sound horrible. I came in egotistical, but came at it like Shakespeare, like, let's create our own language here. So I kind of stole from everywhere. I mean, each line has its own kind of, like, what's your damage? I actually was a camp counselor in Toronto, and I stole that from a little girl who walked around saying, what's your damage? I mean, I'm thinking she's probably like 40 years old now walking around and like, how do they steal this line from my brain, like not making the connection? And how very was very funny because I was like, I'm going to come up with an adjective later, like very blank. And then I would go back and like try and fill in the blank and go, well, why don't I just keep it very, But it's funny to see what lines are very popular. I mean, I was watching the musical last week and they redo the line, lick it up, baby, lick it up, after a vomiting scene. And the audience gave a standing they cheered their heads off. And I'm like, really? That's the line you're going to remember? And then they go in the lobby and they're selling lick it up baby buttons. So, I'm just a shoe cobbler. I just don't know. I just sit there in the workshop and work. Who knows how these things are going to be reacted to?
I want to play a clip of tape of Veronica talking to her mom about the TV coverage of the suicides.
Can't you see these little programs are eating suicide up with a spoon? They're making it sound like it's a cool thing to do.
Are you trying to tell me it is not a time for troubled youth? Stand up straight.
All we want is to be treated like human beings, not to be experimented on like guinea pigs or patronized like bunny rabbits.
I don't patronize bunny rabbits.
Treated like human beings? Is that what you said, little Miss Voice of a Generation? Just how do you think adults act with other adults? You think it's all just a game of doubles tennis? When teenagers complain that they want to be treated like human beings, it's usually because they are being treated like human beings.
Yeah, well, I guess I picked the wrong time to be a human being.
Well, you'll live. Want some pâté?
The pâté is a recurring theme.
Yes. That is autobiographical. My father and my stepmother, they love to pull up pâté at inappropriate situations.
You know, as I said at the outset, the movie really didn't wasn't a hit when it came out in 1989, and it has since achieved this cult status. I mean, what do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, we had a lot of problems with the movie as far as the company that made it went out of business like the week it came out, but I like the kind of underdog status, and certainly it's been a joy watching the movie gain a following. And my brother, who directed Mean Girls, like even that was all in the family, so it was fun that he was stealing from me, but it was all coming together.
Your brother did Mean Girls?
He directed Mean Girls.
What's up with your family?
I guess we both stole from our sister.
So was your sister a popular kid, or was
she
the
outsider?
Oh, yeah, she
was a popular kid. Although the funny thing I always say when people come up to me and say that they were the Veronica of the Heathers of their high school, I always have this theory that every Heathers thinks they were the Veronica. So I've learned not to trust these people.
Daniel Waters is a screenwriter and director. He wrote Heathers, as well as lots of other movies, including Hudson Hawk, Batman Returns, and Demolition Man.
When I was just a little girl, I asked my mother, what will I be? Will I be pretty? Will I be rich? Here's what she said.
Good one. I have to tell you, Warren, I was definitely a Veronica. Not a Veronica masquerading as a Heather.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. Anybody who has ever had a teenage daughter, and I have had several of them, will relate to what we just
Absolutely.
Heard.
Absolutely. And so what's up at 1 o'clock?
Well, anybody who's ever been interested in politics will relate to this. We're going to talk about the Supreme Court decisions this week. Supreme Court's decision this week in the McCutcheon case, which relieved some of the limitations on campaign contributions for very rich people.
Yeah, and
very small number of very rich
controversial
people.
Decision.
Yeah,
very important decision in this campaign season. Look forward to that at 1 o'clock. And Warren Olney. And coming up on this program, no more daily candy for you. The email newsletter is shutting down. We'll find out how it all started 14 years ago when Press Play continues.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, before there was Gilt, Refinery 29, or Groupon, there was Daily Candy. It was a daily email about something, a restaurant, a store, a yoga class that was hot, something that you had to know about. It started back in 2000. 5 years later, the New York Times called it the undisputed grand dam of style sites. And 8 years later, Daily Candy was so popular that Comcast bought it reportedly for $120 million. Now, today, Comcast is closing Daily Candy with the parting words, "It's been sweet." Daily Candy came from the brain and the Rolodex of a former New York Magazine intern and assistant named Danny Levy. She hasn't been with Daily Candy for a few years, but we wanted to find out more about how she started and what she thinks of online trend setting now. Hi, Danny.
Hi.
And today's a sad day for you?
Yeah, it's, you know, sort of to see 14 years of content just go poof. It's a little sad when we're all, you know, a bunch of the team is getting together tonight at the Boom Boom Room as a sort of goodbye. Because it was such, I mean, it was such a great company, and I worked with the most amazing people. I mean, I have to say, it was just, my days there were really, really quite special.
So you started it back in 2000, and in internet years, that was, you know, a lifetime ago.
Yeah. You know, I left really in 2008. When we sold, we had 3 million subscriptions. We had 28 editions and a team of about 45 people. And I'm really proud to say we were profitable beginning in 2001 and every year thereafter.
Take us back then, and what was the scene like for this kind of venture?
I can't say there was much of a scene, to be honest. I had been at New York Magazine, and then I'd moved on. I was a writer and editor there, and then I'd moved on and written for The Times, and then I was at Condé Nast, working on the prototype of a magazine called Lucky, which I'm not sure if you're familiar with.
Yeah, of course.
And I noticed, basically, that I would get emails forwarded from several different people in my life. I get the same email. And I looked at that, and I was like, wow, this is like a really interesting, you've got this built-in marketing tool in the people hitting the forward button. There were no daily emails at that point. One of the things that I'm most proud of, and it is, you know, debatable, some people do credit me with having invented the daily email. I don't know that I invented it, but back then it didn't really exist.
Yeah, back then you didn't get a daily email really that
right.
often. But now
right.
you can get
I mean,
so many
right,
that it gets
back then,
to be
honestly,
too much.
There weren't even HTML emails.
Yeah.
Most people got just the text email.
And but now there's Facebook and there's Twitter and there are other ways of sharing these bits of information.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the landscape has changed dramatically. And I mean, I think what was great about Daily Candy was, you know, at the time in 2000, it was revolutionary. It was, you know, a new thing to do something short and to the point, just one quick thing you needed to know.
And you wrote it, right? Or you, at least at the beginning, you wrote
yes,
it in this voice,
yes.
and it was in the second person, as if you were writing to the person receiving
exactly.
it, like
it
a personal email.
It was meant to be sort of intimate. You know, yeah. it was meant to be like, hey, you know, I used to joke that it was like one big game of show and tell. It's like, look what I found today.
Yeah. And so that's your curation. So it was like a single person or a single company curating something rather
right.
than now on the web, it's a bunch of people curating stuff.
Right. Right. And I think, you know, I think there's space for both. I think there are a lot of trusted voices out there or trusted, you know, brands. And then I think there is, you know, I think that's one way to go. And then I think the sort of community aspect also works. I mean, I think daily emails right now are more difficult. It's a more difficult market for them. You know, I think that...
Why is that?
Well, because everyone's inbox is really crowded now.
Yeah. Although, because there is so much stuff out there, wouldn't there be a need for a curatorial voice to say, this is the one thing that you should check out today?
Yeah, I believe so.
So why isn't that happening?
Well, you know, that was what Daily Candy was. And then I think somewhere along the way, it got a little, you know, the brand got a little confused. I think when Comcast took over, they tried to launch a lot of different products. You know, they saw the popularity of these private sale sites like Gilt and Rulala. So they tried to launch that, and then they saw the popularity of Groupon, and so they launched Daily Candy Deals. And all of a sudden, the subscribers who were used to getting one email or two emails if they subscribed to two different city editions were all of a sudden getting, you know, between five, you know, like five, on a given day getting five emails, which was not the original proposition. It was supposed to be quick, not waste your time, you know, basically in and out. You would know, hopefully, within the first sentence if you were interested. If you weren't interested, God bless, hit delete, you know?
So do you think that Comcast messed it up?
I'm not going to point fingers. You know, it was said in one of the pieces written, this is that, you know, the garden wasn't tended to.
Do you think that maybe there could have been some prudent weeding of that garden?
There could have been some prudent weeding, yeah. And I think it just got lost in the shuffle, you know, and then 2 years ago, they brought in a new CEO, a woman named Allison Moore from HBO. And I really thought if someone could save it, it was her. I guess that didn't happen.
But why not sell it rather than close it?
You know, I don't know. I don't know. It boggles. You know, I decided to put in a courtesy call to my contact over at NBC and say, is there a party line you'd like me to use?
And what did they say?
I didn't hear back.
Well, given the fact that you seem so attached to this idea, and I mean, it was your original idea, your brainchild,
mm-hmm.
and that you think that there is a need for it out there,
mm-hmm.
could you resurrect something similar?
It's being talked about.
Ooh. How mysterious.
You know, but if I were to do something similar, it would be not necessarily so email focused. I think that mobile is huge. I think the voice would have to be cleaned up. You know, I think that when Daily Candy, the voice that it started with in 2000 was this very sort of la, 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 you know. And over the years, a lot of people sort of mimicked that voice. And so I think if I were to start something again, the voice would be sort of sharper and cleaner and more to the point. I would take it back to a sort of simpler, cleaner, you know, sort of what it was in the early days.
Danny Levy, founder of Daily Candy, thanks so much for talking with us today.
Thank you.
Jolie Myers is here now.
I'm going by Heather now.
You're not going to even try with Veronica?
Heather Myers. No. I went straight from being an extra in the background when I was in high school to my adult persona as Heather Myers now.
Nice. Okay, Heather
Myers.
Skip
Veronica
now
completely.
On.
Well, another segment of our show that wasn't the Heathers, though I could have listened to that 6 or 7 times. We asked you to let us know if a CEO's views influenced your buying habits. The CEO of Mozilla, of course, stepped down this week after it was made known that he is not a supporter of gay marriage. On Facebook, Terrence Carner says that the top sets the tone for the rest of the company. So yeah, he does consider CEO views before he buys. On Twitter, Robert points out that he donated to defeat Prop 8, and he asks, should I be hired or fired based on that donation? Nope. And Justin called in to share his opinion. He says he thinks the head of Mozilla should have kept his job.
I didn't think it was necessary to get fired. As a gay male and as somebody who feels strongly about specific political beliefs, I just don't think it was right. People are entitled to their opinion. And forcing somebody out, I think this kind of internet mob has gone far enough. This happens all the time now, and basically nobody's safe at this point.
Well, our internet mob basically said, yeah, it does matter what CEOs are doing, and we will vote with our wallets. Melissa Gary is voting with her clicking finger, though. She uninstalled Firefox this week, told us about it on KCRW's Facebook page.
Okay, if you want to weigh in on our Facebook page, you can. Just go to Facebook and like us. Also, voicemail 1-844-PRESS-PLAY. We're also on Twitter, at KCRW-PRESS-PLAY. I am at The Mad Brand. Jolie Myers, you're at Heather Myers or something now?
At Heather Myers, correct. Okay. KCRW.
Great. All right, Jolie, have a great weekend. And all of you out there, have a great weekend. To the Point is next with Warren Olney. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you on Monday.